सहनावतु सहनावनतु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
17.
Thank you.
अन्तस्तादिस्सहैवाक्षैः बहिर्याति पुनः पुनः बाह्यबुद्धिश्चाञ्चल्यम् साक्षिण्यारोप्यते वृथा अन्तस्ता दीः सह एव अक्षैः बहिः याति पुनः पुनः भास्य बुद्धिस्त चाञ्चल्यम् साक्षिणि आरोप्यते वृथा. अन्तस्तादीः the buddhi vrittis antastha, they are abiding inside. So the buddhi is abiding inside, the buddhi is abiding inside antastha buddhi saha eva akshaihi together. Eva's emphasis, saha means together, together with the sense organs, the buddhi, which is abiding inside, together with the sense organs, akshaihi, together with the sense organs, bahir yati, it goes outside, yati goes, it goes outside again and again. So the antastha buddhi, the buddhi which is inside, abiding inside, stam means abiding or staying, standing, placed, which is inside, saha eva akshaihi, together with the sense organs, bahir yati goes, bahihi, outside, punaha, again and again. Then, basya buddhista chanchalyam, sakshini aropyate vrita. Basya means that which is illumined. Buddhi, the buddhi which is illumined, the buddhista chanchalyam, the agitation, the chanchalya, the movement, the agitation, the changing about the buddhi, or the chanchalyas can be agitation, the agitations of the buddhi, the movements or the motions of the buddhi, the agitation abiding in the buddhi, right? The agitation abiding in the buddhi, which is illumined, abiding in the illumined buddhi, the buddhi which is enjoying consciousness, sakshini aropyate, that chanchalyam, that agitation, is superimposed on the sakshi, sakshini slokata, it's superimposed on the sakshi. Sakshini, so on the superimposed on the sakshi, vritta, falsely. Vritta is almost another word for mithya. That is not really happening. There is no real superimposition at all. But because of jnanam, that superimposition takes place.
Thank you.
You taking a glass of water for your nose? Okay, so let me just say this in a couple of paragraphs in English, and then it runs into the next verse. Okay. Remember this idea of inner and outer. The inner is interior to the body, outer is external to the body. Right, so there's nothing inner or outer from the standpoint of the Atma. Everything is outer, everything is mitya, everything is universe. There's no inner or outer. Inner and outer is from the standpoint of the body. So the buddhi is really part of the sukshma sharira, which is indwells the body, the subtle body, which indwells the physical body. So this buddhi is innermost, as is the manas and the chitta and the ahankara. Let me just spend a moment on these four terms, just so that it's, so that we have the vocabulary. When we say the mind, the word for the mind is antakarana. Antakarana. The inner instrument. Right? The inner instrument, the mind itself, has four categories of thought, four categories of vrittis. One is the buddhi. The buddhi is the decisive mind, the mind that gains knowledge, the mind that can objectify even all of the other types of thoughts and objectify the buddhi and objectify the world and comment on it also, make decisions around it, have clarity. So it's the ones that that is decisive, or the one that has knowledge, and the one who is able to be, I'm going to say that the attitudes or the attitudes with which you handle the things which you objectify. That's all of the buddhi, the knowledge which really determines the way you are internally with your own manas, the fluctuating mind, with your own memories, with your own mental agitations. So when you think about it, the buddhi is the one who gains knowledge, relative knowledge, and then that knowledge impacts the way you behave, right? Just as you grow up, you mature, you gain knowledge, and that knowledge impacts the way you treat your body, mind, sense organs, and you treat the world. So the buddhi really stands for clear knowledge, decisive knowledge. When the buddhi does not have that decisive knowledge, then we come to the manas, which is actually can be objectified by the buddhi. But the manas is full of doubt. It doesn't have clarity. It just has vrittis coming in. It has emotions also. It's really the carrier of emotions. Actually the carrier of the negative emotions. I'll talk about that later. But the negative emotions just arise and are swirling around. They're totally indecisive. The buddhi can come into relationship with an emotion, right? Or with a memory, or it can come into relationship with just the fluctuating mind. It can come into the relationship with perceptions. Just also the buddhi comes into relationship with manas, the one who's receiving all of the input. Inner input, like complexes, etc., or imaginations, or outer input, just like the perceptions, is that a rope or a snake? That's manas. Or even any given perception, which is just simply passing through. I have no comment, basically. It's simply just passing through. It's an experience. The buddhi is the one who can comment or act upon in terms of your knowledge or the way that you handle any inner or outer experience. The buddhi is the one that can have clarity. If it doesn't have clarity, it just simply doesn't know what to do. You know, and so the buddhi is then not functioning, only the manas is functioning. Should I do that or should I do this, or what is the cause of this situation? I don't know what to do. You can't really act on the manas. That's what we mean by doubt. It really inhibits any type of action, because you just simply are stymied. You have not yet made a mistake, a decision. I had one patient some years ago, many years ago, 10 years ago, I think, who had an obsessive compulsive disorder. And what would happen with her is that she would leave her apartment, get down the stairs, and think, did I turn the gas off? The stove. She wasn't sure. So she had to go back up and check. And she would check every burner and the heater, everything, to make sure that everything was turned off. But then she would go down the stairs again, and still she would have another doubt, like, maybe I didn't turn it off, you know, full enough. Maybe there's still some gas leakage. This would go on and on and on. Because the buddhi is not functioning. The buddhi is not there for her to make that decisive decision that she can get down halfway through the steps and say, okay, I turned it off. I remember. I checked it. It's for sure. It is turned off. Let's go. I can go. She couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. That's all manas. Manas is totally in control. It's this or that or this or that or this or that. So doubt, or you're unable to make any type of a decision, is manas. So sometimes you get into that situation in your experience where you're not sure. Like, you don't have obsessive compulsive disorder, but you can get down to the bottom of the stairs and wonder if you turned the lights off. You know, or I wonder about Tibby, did I shut that, the window that she could jump out of and then hurt herself going down the steps? Did I shut that window? I don't remember. So I have to go back up because I don't remember. But then when I see the window is shut, then I can go on my way. That's the situation for most of us, right? But we can't act when the doubt is there. Did I do it? Did I not do it? Did I do it? Did I not? Is it like this? Is it like that? Is it like that? I don't know. So your mind can't make any type of determinative action. The buddhi is the one who makes that decisive action based upon your knowledge, based upon your understanding. So the manas is the one that's just receiving. It's receiving meditative experiences. That's a type of what's called sakshi bhasya. That's it's witnessed by the sakshi. It's actually receiving. The vritti is of whatever is being objectified by the mind. And so, what if for whatever reason, it could be because you're practicing meditation, you've done a lot of pranayama, you know how to do the Ashtanga yoga and take your mind into a deep meditative state, you are now experiencing that meditative state. Right? It's a direct, immediate experience that you're having of say, pure ananda or fullness. But then, that's manas. That's manas. There is no buddhi to comment on that with any certainty. You know? And if you are commenting on it with certainty, when you have no means of knowledge to employ for that, that would be what we call mithyajnanam. It's a false cognition, but you're acting on it. You have a belief in it. So the buddhi, it doesn't mean that the buddhi is, you know, omniscient and always makes, it always makes clear decisions, but the fact that the buddhi is the one who is decisive, and in fact the decisions that you make, the decisiveness really is dependent upon your understanding, upon your knowledge, right? And so say your knowledge itself is not so good. Nevertheless, that knowledge is determining the way that you're interpreting your experience or taking action. The buddhi is the one that has decisive thinking. See what I mean? So that decisive thinking can be based on knowledge that we call jnanam, or mithyajnanam. Could also be false knowledge. You know? Say you mistake a rope for a snake, but then you think, that could have been a rope. I've heard the rope snake story before. Was it a rope or was it a snake? If it's a rope, I can just move on. If it's a snake, I might have to do something about that. Right? So I don't really know if it was a rope or a snake. I thought I saw a snake, but I don't know. It could have been a rope, and I could have just projected the snake on it. This is the confusions of a Vedantin. Okay. But what do I have to do? I have to go back and look at that thing and see if it's a snake or a rope. Buddhi. That's the buddhi. So that is a faculty of the mind, of the antakarana. So the buddhi, sometimes we don't, we translate it, but there's no real knowledge in the translation. It can translate as intellect. Often we use that, but really we should keep the word buddhi and really understand what it is. The other function that we've been talking about is manas, where all this data is just pouring in, even if it's a meditative experience. There's no knowledge to tell you what that experience is in the contextually, but you have had the experience. There's no question of that. It's just how do you hold that experience? What is that experience? Is it this or is that? What is the cause of that experience? What philosophical structure is holding that experience for me? And maybe there is none. I have no idea. But that experience had a level of reality. I know, I just don't know what that level of reality is. So that's manas. So buddhi, manas, chitta. Chitta is memory. My experiences, depending on, you know, how lucky I am, I can actually, with, you know, everything goes into my memory banks, and I can withdraw those. Lucky, I mean, because as you get older, sometimes you can't withdraw the information as quickly as you might like. You know? We have to work on that more and more and keep the mind fresh. But chitta means memory. And the memories can kind of arise. The chitta can kind of arise just by free association. You see something that reminds you of an experience that you have. So memories are being triggered all of the time just by my situation, the chitta. But also, I can consciously remember something. What did I do yesterday? What did I buy at the store when I went to the store? Did I actually buy that? I can call upon my memory, or the memory is the chitta is continually triggered. So now we have buddhi, manas, fluctuating, chitta, memory. The fourth is the ahankara. The ahankara is the product of self-ignorance. It's a type of vritti which identifies, superimposes kind of a mutual, what we call a mutual superimposition. It superimposes my being, myself, the atma, on the body, mind, sense organs, on anything that acts as an upadhi. And that superimposition itself is the ahankara. You don't have to walk around saying, I am the body. Ooh, that's an ahankara. I am sad. Ooh, that's an ahankara. The very fact that there's an identity for you between the body and me, that I am that, you're living that out, actually. You don't have to say it. You just are living that out. Me, the conscious being, is this body. Or this conscious being is my body and my sense organs and my mind, the whole complex. But all of your behavior, all of your thinking is rooted in the ahankara, which is rooted in knowledge. It's rooted in the ahankara because the ahankara is the karaka, the one who identifies with whatever activity is taking place. Activities of perception. I am thinking, I am seeing, I am sad, I am walking, I am talking, I am tired. That's prana, you know. Or my heart is beating too fast. That's prana. Whatever it happens to be, that is me. Me or mine. Right? That's what we call the ahankara, the I notion. And you can see this happening continually, whether you say, I am sad, you use I am sad, of course you can objectify that, or you can objectify the sadness that I am, without the words, it doesn't matter. The identification is there, that's what we call ahankara. That ahankara, that vritti, that category, is the most dominant of all vrittis. The ahankara dominates all vrittis. Because I am always related in one way or another to every experience that I have. And so in some ways, I would say, the ahankara is as constant and pervasive as the self. Because myself, the atma, is present and pervasive and stably present to every experience I have. And since I am there, the self-ignorance is there, and the experience is there, then that gives rise to an ahankara. Right? I'm there, the experience is there, the self-ignorance is there. Right? And so I am always part of in the dyad, subject object dyad, I'm ever present in relationship to the experience, and so is the ahankara, unless I know myself. If I know myself, then the ahankara, it still is functioning operationally, but it's mitya. Like if I say, knowing myself as the Satchitatma, knowing my being, and when the aham, the I rises, it lands on me, but I'm still going to say, I'm going to walk to the store, or, you know, I'm feeling tired, or I have some work I have to do. That's all ahankara. But the use of this ahankara is a mitya ahankara, because it's just language. It's like, instead of saying, the body is walking to the store and the prana is tired and the brain, the mind has to do some thinking now, you know, and be a total weirdo. You can only do that kind of talking like that in class, you know, but not outside. You have to. So the ahankara of these four types of thinking is the most dominant. So we have the antakarana that has four categories of thought, the buddhi, the manas, the citta, memory, right, and the ahankara, the I notion. And so here, so let me go back to this verse. Okay, I want to finish something a little bit more. In the scheme of things, in terms of the manifestation of the creation, we did a little bit of that looking at the sattva. There's a couple of things to understand when we talk about the subtle body. The subtle body means that it is taking, because of karma, this physical body. But this physical body comes into being, goes out of being, has birth and death. The subtle body, that thing, that which is not physical, it doesn't go through the same process of birth and death that the physical body goes through. And so the subtle body is made of sattva, rajas, tamas, which has not gone through panchikarana. The tamas goes through the panchikarana to make this physical world. The sattva and rajas never go through panchikarana. Of the sattva and rajas, so they remain, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, remains subtle. This is the, it's called the sukshma subtle sharira. So the sukshma sharira, it remains subtle. The stula sharira, means it's grossified, not gross, but gross. Means it belongs to this creation that we experience through our sense perception. This physical body is made of always the same materials that the physical, that the world that your experience is made of. And so like this body is made of the earth, it's made of vegetables, you know, it's made of plants, it's made of food, we say annam, it's made of food. And it comes into being and goes out of being. The sukshma sharira does not, because it'll come into being with a kalpa when the creation comes into manifestation, and it'll go out of being, unless enlightenment, it'll go out of being when the creation goes into unmanifest condition. It's not going out of being, it's going into unmanifest condition. So your subtle body has been here forever. Since forever, I mean like this. What do we mean by forever going backwards? It means this. The subtle body is as beginningless as the creation. But it goes into major unmanifest condition when the creation goes into unmanifest condition. When the whole creation is in unmanifest condition, or Ishwara is really just abiding as Brahman with the Maya Upadhi, is unmanifest. The jiva, from the standpoint of within the maya, all of the jivas are there in unmanifest condition. And when the creation comes out again, those jivas also come in to take a birth. So what this means is that this subtle body that you have has been around forever, for a long, long, long time, beginningless past. it never experiences death. It experiences major changes of location. Like, for instance, now, as long as I'm in this body, I'll be wearing out my prarabdha karma, the karmas that caused me to take this body and go all the way through to my death. So this sukshma sharira, subtle body, will be embodying this physical body. But when this physical body drops, then there are many different subtle planes of existence, and as the Shastra will say, there's many pathways that, depending upon your karma, you will take, but they're always within the time and space, within Ishwara's multi-leveled creation, which you yourself have experienced in infinite times. So it's new for you, as though when you've taken this physical body and you have a fresh brain, you bring in some samskaras, some tendencies into that body, and you bring the karma that's being manifest into that body. But most of us do not really have a memory of our past lives, or most of us are not able to travel to different lokas and remember who I was related to, and all of these types of astral traveling, which the Shastra accepts. It accepts it. That's not really our interest in Vedanta, but it's accepted. But for most of us, we don't have those types of memories. We don't have access to them. Okay? But that doesn't mean that once this body drops, we're now in very familiar territory. You know, very familiar territory. Because we've done it millions and millions of times, you know, countless times. So that's this. We are travelers through many, many different lokas, through all the 14 lokas, or through all the 14 worlds. We are travelers all through this infinite expression of Ishwara, and have been from beginningless time. So you've probably, as a jiva, done anything you can think of. You've been probably really saintly. You've probably experienced many times on every different loka. You've probably been to the Satya Loka and then had to come back just as a jiva at the end of that kalpa. You've probably had plenty of times in different hell lokas, you know, and countlessly all of the time arriving back here, right? So you, in terms of this individual person, you know, has a really long history. And that history is much more available to you when you drop this physical body, because now you're in familiar territory, you know, and that history is more available to you. They say that, say, when you're at the time of death and before you take another physical body, your memory span is much longer. Like the memory span for the normals, like me and most of you probably, your memory goes back to whenever you know that when you were born and then up through when you were die. Not necessarily the lifetimes that you had before. But when you drop this body, there's a lot bigger span of memory. This is like just one dress of many dresses. This is like one chapter of many, many, many chapters. But right now you think this is it. You know, especially if you're from a Judeo-Christian heritage, often the feeling, unless you get into the mystics, this is it. You have one chance here. It's interesting that in the East they don't have that. This is it. They don't have that at all. They know this is not it. They know that they've had many, many lifetimes before. They also know that, and know means that they're contained in that belief system. They've had many lifetimes before, and this lifetime, this particular lifetime, will have the prarabdha karma that takes them all the way through, which is directly, immediately related to what they did in their last life. And so even though they will have kind of a countless, infinite number of what they call sanchitta karmas, unmanifest karmas waiting to be manifest, who you are at the time of death is going to attract these karmas. Are you doing yours?
Yes.
Okay. It's going to attract the karmas that are relevant to who you are right now. And so, from a, because, say, in among the Hindu, in the Hindu culture, or I'd say even more in the Eastern culture, reincarnation is, that's the containing myth. They're born with that, they have centuries of that, they have no doubt about that. But that makes the way you behave in this world, the following of Dharma, so important. It's so important because it will play into, for samsara, it will play into the next birth that you have. So if you want to improve your condition, or keep your condition at least as good as it is, that Dharma is very, very important because you'll be accruing punya instead of accruing papa, which will give you negative experiences. So this is all just totally ingrained. This is the buddhi. It's ingrained in the buddhi, you know, not just memory. It's their understanding of the way they understand their experience, you know, the way they relate to their experiences from that containing, the shraddha in that containing myth, which they own, which they own. Dharma also is very important just to be able to enjoy any type of shanti. Mm-hmm. You also know that if it's a choice between pleasure and pain and dharma, if there's a choice, you have to choose dharma or it will be punishing even though it's pleasurable. So dharma, it always comes first. If pleasure and pain take place, are not in conflict with dharma, there's no problem. There's no problem at all. It's like a gift. Yeah. No conflict. But if there is a conflict, then you have to back out. And so, even with this understanding, the practice of all of the values, Amanik, Twam, Ahimsa, Kshanti, Arujavan, that I talked about a little before, non-injury and kindness, accommodation, honesty, truthfulness, honesty in the way that you present yourself instead of presenting yourself like a rich person when you're poor, you know, or trying to or bragging about your accomplishments thinking that'll make people like you more, you know. That's all it is. People may like me, they may respect me a little more if they knew that I had done this, or they knew that I had done that. And so I'll just throw that out there. You know, thinking that'll make you love me. You know, sad. We all have our own little things. Those are the kind of things that need to drop off. Okay, so we've got the sukshma sharira. So let me, the all sattva and rajas, the mind and the sense organs are sattva. They reflect consciousness. The prana is what enlivens this physical body. When it dies, that prana is gone. So the prana and the organs of action, and then along with the mind, comes to 19 components. You know? And these 19 components take body, which is really more you. It's not the right way to say it, but it's a you that lasts longer than the body. Let's put it that way. Okay, but now this sukshma sharira, which is taking body after body after body, never experiences any death because the self doesn't die. And just the self is changeless. And so just like the dropping of this physical body is already inert. It's enlivened. This is an enlivened body by the subtle body. So when this body grows old and dies, it drops off, but nothing happens to the subtle body. Again, there are two orders of reality, right? So the subtle body just moves on within the creation according to karma and experiences different realms of existence. But the subtle body, you traveling around, having dropped this body and you have to take another one, that you is Brahman, is me. It's the same me. So you, on two levels, you never experience any death. You don't experience any death in terms of the myself, which is free from time and change, right? And the sukshma sharira never experiences any death. It just experiences a lot of change because it's a traveler and it continues to take on different bodies, and it has a buddhi and a manas, which is reacting to experience, and it has memories, right? And so it is having a lot of experiences, but still, it's still the same non-dual self which is illumines, which is the very me of the subtle body, and the subtle body is the one that within this, within Maya, takes on physical body after physical body after physical body, according to the karmas, according to your karmas. So there's two parts that don't die. The self never dies, it never changes. It is the non-dual self of the whole creation. And the sukshma shariras are different and separate, and they're the ones that travel around, but also don't die. They don't die, but they come to an end with knowledge. They come to an end with knowledge because knowledge removes the ahankara. Knowledge removes the false person. So let me just say, it removes this false fellow. Removes this false fellow. The one who is brought about, whose existence is like the snake on a rope, just a manufactured as though by self-ignorance. This is the great thing about ignorance. Ignorance does not change the reality of something. It doesn't change what is. But it certainly can project upon what is something else. Like, for instance, with the rope snake example, if I see the rope as rope, there's not going to be the projection of a snake. Won't happen. But if I see just the bends of the rope, I see the thisness of the rope, but not the ropeness of the rope. Okay. So I'm experiencing the thisness of the rope without experiencing the ropeness of the rope. Then the thisness of the rope, which would be like it's 5 feet long and has three bends and in 1 inch diameter, for instance, you know, that's what I experience, and that experience that I'm having, since I don't know what it is, becomes the locus for projection. And so I could actually, depends on what my mind wants to do with it, I could take that thing, you know, as a rope, or as a stick, or as a crack in the earth, for instance, you know, or a stream of water. Anything that could possibly fit that shape, right? And so the ignorance of the rope is required for that projection. To get rid of that projection, it's not good enough for somebody to say, ah, that's not really a rope, you know? That's really the snake. That's not really a snake. That's a rope. And you say, really? Well, how is it a rope? Like, how is that? I saw the snake. You're telling me it's a rope. Well, I saw the snake. And I said, well, what you have to end up doing is say, no, you can't say like this, I promise. Because I promise. Because then it's your word against theirs. You're asking that person to give up what they had a direct, immediate experience of by telling them they didn't have that experience, when actually they did have that experience. It's a projection, but not for them. It's not a projection for them until they see the rope. They could be dissecting the snake and doing all kinds of things with this, imaginally, all kinds of things with that snake. Until they see the rope, the snake doesn't go away. So the problem in this example is rope ignorance. I'm in this situation with myself. The mind, right, does not know me, has not no viveka. My mind, the sukshma sharira, remember, the mind belongs to the sukshma sharira, which is traveling forever, yeah, until it comes to an end. That mind has self-ignorance. Because it has no means of knowledge to, you know, flip around and look at me. Oh, look at that, you know. there really is this viveka, this discrimination between me, the mind, and the self. That discrimination is there. And look around. Turn yourself around right now. Take a look at that. Well, you know what? You can't do that. You cannot do that because of a number of reasons, but I'd say the main reason is that you have no means of knowledge, and the mind doesn't have a means of knowledge to flip around like that. But the other problem is that this self that you are, right, in terms of the relationship between satyam and mithya, there is this half-truth, this amazing half-truth. And the amazing half-truth is that the mind, just like the clay pot, says, the pot says, I am clay, which is true. Right? I am clay is true. It is clay. And so the mind says, I am the conscious being, because it's sattva. It says, I am the conscious being. That is true. The me that pervades the mind, that is present to the mind, is very much like how the pot is present to the clay. And so it's the me that is me, right, is there abiding as the very self of the mind. And this me is what I care about. And there's no distance between me and the mind. Me and the buddhi. Because the mind, buddhi, the manas, the buddhi, is mithya. Mithya is 100% dependent on satyam, what is actually there, for it to even exist. And so for the buddhi, the only thing that really is there is me, is conscious being. And there is no distance between the buddhi and the aham. The only problem, so that's not the problem. You are, the buddhi says, I am the conscious being, it is true. The problem is that the conscious being is free of the buddhi. The buddhi is a different order of reality. It is mithya. You know? Like the pot is the clay, but the clay has no dependence on the pot at all. From the standpoint of the clay, there's only clay. Where's the pot? Be the clay. Where's the pot? There's only me there. This is what the buddhi cannot know because it's coming from that mithya, it's coming from its own standpoint. And from its own standpoint, it totally enjoys consciousness as much as the pot totally enjoys the clay. But from the standpoint of non-dual conscious being, me, the only thing that is here is me. Only me. There are no edges. There is nothing that is not me. Because the buddhi has no being at all. The universe has no being. It's mithya, we experience it, but it has no being to rub up against and delineate, you know, or put a border or a border around awareness. Awareness is free of time and space. It cannot have any borders. There's no time, there's no space, there are no borders at all. There is nothing but me. And there is no part of the creation, including the body, mind, sense organs, which is other than me. And so the sattva, the sense organs and the mind, are ripe for this mistake, for this superimposition, for this lack of viveka. Because they're half correct and they have no means of knowledge, you know, no Archimedean point to really look, the buddhi to turn around and see, you know, how could I be different from the self? Because I'm not different from the self. But the self is different from it, because the self is non-dual. It's a different order of reality. It's not circumscribed by anything. So this non-dual self, which doesn't take up any space, the whole creation is an expression of that. But from the stand, just think of it. From the standpoint of the creation, there's this part of the creation, because time and space, there's this part, and this part. And so the self, myself, is as though divided up, but only from the standpoint of these mithya objects, all objects. From the standpoint of the all creation, I could say, well, you know, there's these higher lokas of Ishvara and the lower lokas, the lower worlds of Ishvara. You know, we could divide it up infinitely. into big portions and small portions, into jivas, we divide it infinitely. But not from the standpoint of the self. From the standpoint of the self, there's only me here. From the standpoint of the clay pot, the clay, there's only me. There's only clay. There are no edges. The edges take place in time and space, not in me. And that knowledge is not available to the Sukshma Sharira until it's exposed to a means of knowledge that is able to shine a light on that. Advaita Vedanta does that. I think there are other traditions also that do that. Very few of them that I know of, there might be even more, but there are other traditions that actually are able to do that. And that is exactly what they do. They shine a light on this satya mitya situation that we find ourselves in, and differentiate the mitya from the satyam. They differentiate the objectifiable experiences that upon analysis don't exist, because they're infinitely divisible. There's really no nama-rupa. There's only what we call conglomerates of nama-rupas, little nama-rupas stuck together to make bigger nama-rupas, which are stuck together with other, you know, goes on and on and on. But all of these nama-rupas, these names and forms, they all go into an infinite regress. But yourself is not a nama-rupa. Nama-rupa is a mitya. It's not a name and form. It's not a conglomerate of name and forms. It's non-dual. You know? And it is the very being of all names and forms, and including time and space, which creates this dimensional illusion. All based upon self-ignorance. And so, in order to get out of this samsara, right, one has to gain knowledge which puts the ahankara in the self. The ahankara lands on the non-dual atma, becoming the aham, the me. Ahankara means it's created, it's notional. Knowledge takes off the kara of the aham. And the aham lands on me as the non-dual self, the me, the conscious being. Right? And then what is all of this? All of this is Ishvara. All of this, including the body, mind, sense organs, is Ishvara. Why? Because if the satya mitya is clear with this teaching, the only thing here is conscious being. Not inert Mother Nature. It is a conscious being. You are a conscious being. So the whole creation, if you're a conscious being because of the sattva, Ishvara is a conscious being because of the sattva. The sattva, rajas, and tamas is maya. Sattva, rajas, tamas. From the standpoint of Ishvara, the maya projects as the entire infinite creation, which is comprised of equally a smear of sattva, a smear of rajas, a smear of tapas. Sattva, rajas, tamas. There is nothing to impede any of those sattva, rajas, tamas to divide it up from the standpoint of Ishvara, because it's the whole upadhi. And so the same conscious being which this sukshma sharira enjoys and then takes on this physical sharira, physical body, that same me is the very me that reflects off of the whole creation. And so there is no inert Mother Nature. Mother Nature is Ishvara. Mother Nature is conscious being. Because there is nothing but conscious being. And the conscious being is the very knownness. It's the very knownness that the creation enjoys. The very knownness that you enjoy. There's nowhere there's a knower. There's the known. The self-evident knownness of consciousness, which when the Maya Upadhi projects, the infinite Maya Upadhi projects, it is known because I am known. So from Ishvara's standpoint, you know, the whole infinite creation is known because from the standpoint of Ishvara, it's not being viewed, the me-ness is not being viewed from the limited mind of all of the jivas. The whole thing because of the sattva and because of the whole nature of the self as an expression of consciousness, this whole thing is only me. And this whole thing, even being there, is from the standpoint of the Maya Upadhi itself. From the standpoint of Brahman, of consciousness, it is just me. I am here, without the words. Just conscious being, which manifests as Maya, and with the manifestation, there is knowledge. That's why Swamiji calls the projection of the entire the projection of the whole creation, the entire creation, is the projection of infinite knowledge. Maya is infinite knowledge, unmanifest infinite knowledge becomes manifest infinite knowledge. So it is known, the whole creation is known, right? Because of the knownness of the Atma, the knownness of the self. Now say you gain this knowledge that the Ahankara is now mithya, and you and the aham lands on you, on Brahman, the self that you are, right? Then this mithya, this body, mind, sense organs, belongs to Ishvara. But because it doesn't belong to you, in fact, the whole Maya Upadhi, also we call it Ishvara because it has the Atma as itself. You have the Atma as yourself. There's only one Atma. There's only one self. And that self manifests as Ishvara. But Ishvara has many parts. So viewing yourself from the perspective of all of these parts, from the perspective of within Ishvara, you become limited. The little jivas, the little minds become limited because they have limited knowledge. But what about when you have self-knowledge? Then that ahankara is gone. The ahankara becomes mithya. And actually, honestly, there is only Ishvara. Mm. It's not like you're something else. Mm. Well, let me just jump into Ishvara. You exist within time and space. You're part of the Maya Upadhi. And so you are part to the whole. So that's why the Buddhists and the Vedantins very clearly, and even the Sankhya in a little different way, they see the whole projection of the creation as one interconnected whole. And those two different darshanas will say something differently about that, but this one interconnected whole as Maya, you know, has me for itself. And from the standpoint of me, there is only me because Maya has no being to delineate me. You know? And so where is there going for me now, once that knowledge is clear and the aham is with me and the ananda is with me, the fullness that I've been searching for, trying to get the blood out of a stone, you know, because it doesn't exist in an object. Yes, I've been searching for that. I found it. And it is my own self. Now there's nowhere else to go. The game is over. How will I reincarnate? Why would I reincarnate? Because just like, say you get to enjoy a moment of deep happiness or deep fullness in the world, you don't go, how long do I have to... It's kind of not like that. You know? You don't want to leave that. It's everything. It's everything that a person has been seeking for. And so when the buddhi really is at home with that, you just like to be home. You like to stay at home, and the prarabdha is still running out, so this body, mind, sense organs is in what we call empirical reality, because it's Ishvara, you know. But the sukshma sharira, the mind, it likes to stay home, and staying home, we let Ishvara do his thing. Let the prarabdha, you know, let me experience the prarabdha until it's over. When the prarabdha karma is over, you know, the karmas that caused me to take this birth, when those karmas run out, there's no one there to take another birth. Because the mind is already, you know, situated in myself. So we say that the whole sukshma sharira And physical body, of course, goes back to its parts. This to earth goes back to earth, etc., dust to dust. The subtle body goes back to its subtle parts. It goes back to the rajas and tamas. It goes back to the sattva and tamas elements. It goes back into the subtle elements because there's no ahankara, there's no kernel of ignorance there to keep that thing going. To keep that ahankara is already gone. The ahankara is gone. It's only mitya, it's only language. But there's no ajnana, there's no real ahankara. It's just playing itself out in terms of language. I still have a body and I still have a mind and sense organs as long as I have karma left. When the karma is over, then there's no one ready and willing to move on. It all dissipates back into the creation. And so that's when this traveling jiva from beginningless time comes to an end. It's a product of ignorance, and it's removed by knowledge. And if you say, I'm not ready for that. I want to stay here. I want another few births. And Bhagavan said, it's okay. You can stay as long as you want.
Yes.
No problem. Don't worry about it. Because the ahankara is still saying, no, not yet, not. No. I'm not sure. Okay, that was an introduction to this next set. Om Tat Sat.
Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.